You're listening to episode 15 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, storytellers, we have director, writer, producer Frank Hall Green on the show with us today. His directorial feature film debut, Wildlike, is premiering in theaters and on demand this Friday on September 25th. In Frank's movie Wildlike, 14-year-old Mackenzie, a troubled teenage girl, is sent to live with her uncle in Alaska while her mother is in treatment. Mackenzie runs away and an unlikely friendship with Bartlett, a loner backpacker, forms in the Alaska wilderness. When Bartlett finally discovers her alarming secret, he must make a bold choice to take responsibility for Mackenzie and help her escape her traumatic past and return home. I'm excited to have Frank on the show with us today, so let's jump right in. Frank, thank you so much for being here with us. Before we jump in and chat a bit about Wildlike, tell us a little bit about how you got into this world of directing and producing and screenwriting.
Probably the long answer just starts with me growing up sort of being an artist of some kind. I just had a natural ability to draw and to paint and sculpt and things like that from as far back as I can remember. So I was always interested in the arts and in creating things, and that's where I spent a lot of my energy and time, both in school and at home. And as I got to the end of high school, I even looked at possibly going to an arts college, a fine arts college, but decided I didn't want to commit myself into that world and ended up going to NYU as an undergraduate. In terms of film, I had started taking photography in high school just as another extension of the arts and became interested in photography and images. And then my parents had this terrific collection of art films, foreign films, old films. And I just knew none of this stuff. And in my junior year in high school, I started watching, just randomly putting in VHS tapes of things I'd never heard of before. And they were so good, I kept putting in more and more and literally watched hundreds of movies in my junior and senior year of high school. So by the time I got to NYU as an undergraduate for general education, I just had an interest in film cursorily, and I took a cinema studies class and I started taking more photography. I did end up taking a little bit of film production, no intention of being a filmmaker, and actually no intention of even staying in the arts. I just really wanted to get a sort of a well-rounded education. And then after college, I ended up going into business, and I missed the arts so much after several years of that I decided to think about going back to school. And it just dawned on me that film might be a place that I could merge interest I had in lots of different areas, as well as be involved in the arts, as well as be involved in business somewhat. And I applied to film schools. And by the time I got into the NYU grad film program, I was pretty excited and committed to do that. So that's kind of set me off as a filmmaker. And that was 30 when I got back to NYU as a grad film student.
Oh, wow. And how was your time at film school?
It was great. I loved it. I'm sure people have told you film school is not cheap. It's expensive in and of itself, and then it's expensive to make these short films continually. And it's very time intensive because you're either in class or you're studying or you're watching films or you're writing films or you're out working and crewing on films, and you can always find time to do one or the other. And you do that for about 3 years, and then you're supposed to make a thesis film on top of that. So for most people through the NYU program, it becomes sort of a 4 to 5 year endeavor. You have a structure of learning for film, and so you do feel rather schooled at least in the art of making independent small films by the time you complete the program.
Mm-hmm. And could you tell us a little bit about your thesis film?
The film ended up being a short feature, I think it's about 77 minutes, maybe 80 minutes, feature doc about my own experience being shot with a gun. And what happened was, in my third year of film school, I was a teaching assistant working in the cinematography class, helping the instructors there, and on a Friday night in September. And I walked home after class, which was about 9 o'clock, and lived in the West Village at the time on Hudson Street, just above Leroy St. Luke's, just kind of like 3 blocks above Houston in the West Village. And I was walking from 7th Avenue to Hudson Street, and that block actually curves, it turns, rather than being a straight block. you can't see from one end to the next, which actually causes it to be a little bit dark and dim. And there's a park on one side that shuts down at like 6 p.m. So as I was walking along that block, there were two guys standing right at the turn of the block. And one was standing on the curb and the other one was sort of standing next to in front of the brownstone steps. So in order to walk down the sidewalk, you had to walk between them. And I saw them from about, I don't know, maybe 25 yards away. And they gave me this questionable feeling like they were going to give me a hard time, not in a dangerous way, but that they were going to, I don't know, hassle me, play a joke on me. They just could, I don't know why I got that feeling. And I just kept walking, thinking as I got closer to them that turning around or crossing the street was somehow going to be a provocative measure, that the best course of action would be just to walk straight through them and mind my own business, as New Yorkers do. And so I just sort of put blinders on and walk straight ahead. And when I got up to them, the one standing on the curb, he put his hand out in front of me as if to stop me. And he said, "Hold up, nigger."
Oh, wow.
And I just kept walking, didn't pay any attention to him, didn't even look him in the face, I don't think. I heard this loud bang and they took off running. And I thought that they had set off a firecracker or something of that nature to scare me, you know, just this obnoxious prank. They looked like maybe they were in their very early 20s. And then about 30 seconds to a minute later, I started to feel a lot of pain, like a burning sensation around my waist in the front. And it didn't feel like it was on the inside of me, though it felt like it was on the outside. It felt like someone was holding a match to my stomach. And I looked down and I didn't see anything. And I thought, huh, that's funny. They must have fired like a BB gun or, you know, some sort of maybe a firecracker, and just set off like near me, and it's, you know, burning me and I can't figure out how. And I kept walking and the pain increased, it, you know, the burn continued and grew. And then I looked down again and I saw under my belt line that I was bleeding, and I thought, okay, well, maybe it was a BB gun, it penetrated the skin. So it's like each step further of pain, I was coming more and more in tune with the reality that it was more than just a small prank. I walked on the rest of the block to the corner of Hudson. There was a restaurant on the corner at the time. I walked into the restaurant and it was pretty empty. And I walked up to the waiter and I said, "I think someone shot me up the block here." And you know, he was sort of stunned, didn't know what to think. And I tried to sit down, but that was too painful. So I laid down on the ground, and then it became a real scene. And he called 911, and I noticed that there was sort of blood and a wound on the left, but then there was also one on the right. So the bullet had actually gone in on the left and gone across my stomach and it exited on the right. And within a few minutes, a policeman was there and he started asking these sort of very criminal related questions of what did these guys look like and all this stuff. And the, you know, and I didn't know what to think. And then an ambulance came, and then it became very much like an episode of ER, where it threw me in the ambulance, rushed to, what's the hospital? It's shut down now over on 7th Avenue at 13th Street, you know, and pushed me in the ER doors. And it ended up that I was fine. The bullet had just gone through basically muscle tissue and fat tissue and my skin and had not hit any major organs. And they literally sent me home the next day. But I don't know who they were or what they were doing or wanted and what it was all about. They didn't take anything. And so it was just a strange experience. And on top of that, my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, we had had this very severe breakup just prior to this. So it sort of catapulted our relationship back into a good place, which I wanted to have happen. And she was out of town at the time. And so it was sort of this a lot of emotional drama for me, where normally one would focus a lot on the shooting and sort of the criminal aspect of it. For me, a lot of it was on the emotional aspect around the relationship. So I made this sort of documentary that involved a remake, you know, a sort of a live action sequence of the shooting as I remembered it, and then interviews and just sort of recounting the whole experience for myself. And it was an interesting process. It's a very personal documentary. I never sent it to any film festivals or anything. It wasn't meant to have a life beyond close friends and family.
Wow, I can't believe that happened. You really need to live life every single day like it's your last day. Was that kind of something that happened for you as well?
I wish it was as cut and dry and dramatic as that. Being a person who's involved in the arts and always sort of reaching and trying to get the most out of life, I don't know that was something that that dramatically changed for me. It's just sort of a very odd thing. I'm not used to playing the victim. I usually feel like I'm the cause of things for good or for worse in my life. So I think that was an interesting perspective. I was broken up with my wife, Molly, and that was really my fault. And then here were these guys sort of coming after me, which was clearly not my fault. Maybe it was a turning moment in the sense of here's a great opportunity where one could feel sorry for oneself or sort of go into victimhood. And I really wasn't in a place where I could do that.
I'm blown away by that story, and I see how you don't victimize yourself at all. This actually does tie in with Wildlike. I noticed that the main heroine, she does not victimize herself. Do you feel like that somehow segued into that storyline, that spirit of fighting and surviving?
Now that you bring it up, I think it does. I mean, one of the things I wanted to set out for Mackenzie through the story, which, and I'm not sure it comes out entirely, is I didn't want her to be this incredibly innocent, sympathetic character of she never does anything wrong and whoa, this happens to her and she's so unfortunate for this to happen. She makes plenty of bad choices and she's presented in a way that she's clearly been difficult in one way or another. She does have this moment with Bart where she jumps back in his car. She's not feeling the victim, but she is feeling sort of like at her wit's end, and she almost sort of throws a temper tantrum by screaming at him and saying, you don't understand, and this sort of thing. And just thinking this, she cries and wails loud enough, then it will shake his attention, which it does, so that he'll take her situation in it from a different perspective.
Mackenzie was so beautifully fleshed out with so many layers. How were you able to dive that deep with her character? Did you know people directly that you drew inspiration? How did that go about?
She wasn't based on any one particular person. I mean, the overarching answer is that I worked very hard to make sure that I brought as many dimensions as possible if they do come across into the script and into the characters. And it was an important goal in the making of the film and the writing of it and any writing of any film. One of the reasons I became interested in the subject is because I knew a girl when I was a teenager who shared her experience with me. And then other women and girls I had known growing up shared similar experiences with me. I don't know why they did. I guess because they trusted me and I, you know, was willing to listen. And I think I just became attuned to the subject. I have heard more stories and been in tune with that sort of thing. And I had a family member that worked with predators and were coming out of prison. And that was an interesting perspective. And I'm a person who's not afraid to get into deeper conversations with people. And I guess those are really learning experiences from a writer standpoint. I was very intimidated of the idea of trying to write this 13, 14, 15-year-old girl, whatever age she was going to be. And I didn't know exactly how I was going to go about it. And you can't really go and befriend and stalk 13, 14-year-old girls, which was a challenge. And you have to observe and tap into what's important to other people and what they're going through and listen and just open your ears and listen. There's young teenagers and all sorts of people all over, especially in New York, and you can eavesdrop and listen in and just hear what people are thinking and going through. And then I read a lot. I read things that were being written by girls on the subject. So I guess I developed a voice for it at some point. And, you know, and let's be honest, she doesn't talk a whole lot in the film. So
that's what I loved about it. That's also a heavy part of why I felt it was very truthful, because a lot of times it's so hard to talk about things like that if it happens to you, mm-hmm. You know, and it's especially when she had no one to really trust, especially from a guy's point of view, writing it from a young girl's. I was like, you must know somebody or something, you know? I'm like, wow, what about Bart? I love Bart. He is fantastic. Is there like a part of you in Bart?
Yeah, I'm Bart through and through. I'm just, yeah. Really aspires to be me, actually. No, not at all. I mean, I think all the characters, you know, in some way or another are lighter and darker parts of me. And, you know, everybody aspires. I think all men aspire to be Bart. And I think given the right circumstances, all men can be Bart. And, you know, on the uncle side, I mean, certainly men are tempted by women and sexuality in lots of different ways. Plenty of guys come in a situation where they need to act like Bart, whether they do or not. So all of that is pretty standard in the male persona, but I did try to make him as he keeps to himself. He's fairly conservative. He's not actually an extremely accepting character. You know, he's fairly judgmental. He has his idea about the way things work. He's very scientific. He's black and white. He's not a big conversationalist. He's not really confused, or he doesn't want to be. But because of the circumstances, he becomes an extremely accepting person for her situation. You meet him at his best, put in a situation where he inevitably ends up being the best that he can be, but he's not doing it on purpose. You know, it's just the way he's cornered into the situation.
Yeah, you did such a fantastic job with the cast. They were all really perfect.
They were great. I mean, some of it's just luck. You know, we went after different actors and, you know, obviously we went after ones that we thought would be able to carry the performances we wanted to see. And we got really lucky, especially with the way that they got along together.
Mm-hmm. What was the most difficult scene?
The abuse scene was the hardest scene. And in other circumstances, it wouldn't necessarily have to be, but the dynamics of it are tricky for a number of reasons. One, it's a very sensitive topic and it's uncomfortable for everybody. And then you have this scene where it's obviously the actual act of it is not okay and not permissible. So the actors need to, you know, play that out in a way that's comfortable for each other. And then the actors themselves, you know, portraying those roles, there's a level of emotionality for them that goes into it that's not comfortable. And then you have the camera work. I approached it from a very mechanical standpoint where I laid out storyboards and pictures of, you know, this is what we're going to see. This is where the camera's going to be. This is what we're going to do. And we all had a meeting and it was just very technical of saying, okay, we're going to shoot this shot and this is what's going to happen in the shot. And then we're going to shoot this shot. And that's what's going to happen and so forth. And everybody went through it. It was difficult in different ways for different people involved in that scene. So managing that whole situation was the hardest and making sure that we got what we needed or what I felt like would portray things the way I wanted to portray them on screen. That was the hardest. Overall, it was just difficult on a day-to-day basis, watching your script come to life always a little bit differently and in an unexpected way and always cutting a few things or trimming a few things or changing a few things, and which wears on you and your confidence and your ability to predict how it's coming out. And then you do that day after day after day for about 5 weeks. It becomes pretty destabilizing. And so by the end of the shoot, you're like, I think I got something, but I'm not sure. And then there are days where I was like, we're never going to get what we need. I was definitely days where I had zero confidence and didn't keep me from going forward. But in the back of my mind, there were certain moments where I was like, oh, well, that's not going to work. It's never going to work, which was not necessarily true.
The choice of using Alaska, was that intentional?
Well, it was certainly intentional. You know, I'm a lover of the outdoors. I'm a backpacker myself. In fact, I went to Alaska the first time on a backpacking trip to Denali with my wife. And we went to some of those same spots that Bart and Mackenzie go to. So I knew it was this fantastic, open, far away, beautiful landscape that someone could disappear into, get lost in, or be lost in, or run away to. And so when in concocting the overall story, Alaska immediately popped into my mind as a perfect geography. And in fact, sort of almost the only geographical location for it. I wish I could recall exactly the moment when it dawned on me that I should set it in Alaska, because there was a moment where I was thinking the Northwest. And I was even thinking about setting it, you're going to think this is crazy, but on the eastern end of Long Island.
What? Like Montauk and Hamptons?
Exactly.
Oh.
This was just when it was about the girl, or I think actually there at one point there was a girl and a brother, and they were just going to run away. You know, they were abused, or one of them was abused, and they were going to run away. And that's as much as I guess I had that first. Or I guess I had first that I knew these young people were going to run into nature. Because I think the healing power of nature, just as important as showing the social issue of sexual abuse. And so the two went very well hand in hand. And then once I had those two elements, I realized that if I really wanted them to get lost and to really have no one to turn to and no easy way out, then I needed to put them, her, as it became, in Alaska. And then the idea of Alaska being America's last frontier and really the only place that has that innocence of landscape became a nice parallel to what Mackenzie's experiencing as a young teenager.
I know before you mentioned about the mechanical way of shooting the very sensitive scene, the abuse. You mentioned you storyboarded, and that's something I'm really curious about as well. And did you storyboard all the other scenes as well?
Not all of them, a lot of them. What I did do is once we had a shooting script, I had a reference list of films that I respected and liked and wanted to emulate, indie films from the last 10, 15 years and some older. and I had notes about some things I wanted to try and do. So I went through the scenes and tried to break them down as I saw them in terms of how many shots or what would the shot be or where would the camera be? What would the scene look like? And sometimes those would then turn into a storyboard, just if I specifically wanted to show something to Hillary, the cinematographer, or experiment with something for myself. I mean, as I said, I grew up drawing and painting, so I'm not intimidated by the idea of putting it down on a storyboard, although I'm probably judgmental of my own work in a way that other people wouldn't be. I'm thinking that's a horrible drawing, but it's a storyboard. So, but it is not stick figures. And it would show, you know, okay, if it's over the shoulder with a hint of her ear or what, then I would try to be descriptive in that.
How was that writing process?
I definitely write from a visual standpoint. As I said with Wildlike, I think it started with the image of a young person running in nature. And I think that's something that I've been obsessed with for sort of a while. And then as I write, I have to really be able to picture the scene in my mind, see it before I can write it. So frequently what's going to happen, or I can see what's going to happen before I know what they're going to say. And I'll also know sort of visually what a turn of events or what locations I want to see them in or how I want to see the characters interact with each other in different ways through the movie before I sit back and say, okay, does this actually work as a story? Are there arcs? Are the characters changing or how are they interacting? And then the very last level, for better or for worse, is sort of who is this character and what do they want? And all the important things that one might start with, you know, sort of what's the premise and what am I saying in this script? I think even now that Wildlike's done, there's things coming to light of like, oh, I actually was saying this and that really wasn't that important to me, or I didn't think it was when I was putting it down on paper. I mean, the things that were important to me when I was writing Wildlike were like, getting them out into Alaska and sending Bart and Mackenzie on this journey and the different twists and turns that happen between them, all the reflections between a young person and an old person and shame and innocence and all the different themes that go into it. I didn't map those out. They just came off the page as I wrote the journey more and more. And now that I'm into a few new scripts, it's very clear that that's a process for me, and it's an okay process as long as one takes the time at some point along the way to say, okay, now let's step back and see how what the character's saying here, how the audience is feeling, is everything moving forward, and or you're going to be fixing those problems in post in the editing room, and if you don't have enough footage, then that can be a real problem.
There's so much happening in the process of creating. Is there a way that you can recommend how to organize and really capture all the important notes?
It generally starts with an image or with an idea of a particular character that I can see in a setting. And if I become excited about the idea of what the story might be behind this character or what they're about to get into, then I'll write it down in an email to myself so that, you know, just whatever occurs to me and just so I don't, like you said, just so I don't forget it. Send that email to myself and it will go in one of two places. It'll either go in a folder called film ideas and maybe never be heard from again, or if it for some reason gains importance, then I will reopen the email and reply to myself and I'll add to it. And it could be something as, for example, with Wildlike, it'd be like, oh, well, a girl running into nature, that's great, but I forgot I took this backpacking trip in Alaska, and Alaska would really be a fantastic location. And so I would add just that simple point, and then I would email back to myself and reply again to the email and flesh it out further. And then once I've clearly investing my time in it, I would purposefully try to sit down and think, or when I was on the subway or had free time or just when it dawned on me or something interesting happened, I would always have that email sitting in my inbox that I could just jump into and reply on and add more notes. After a matter of weeks, months, years, maybe in some cases, that email will become very, very long. And I would just I'll take the whole thing and I'll copy and paste it into a Word document, and I'll try to clean it up a little bit just to reorganize things in terms of, you know, okay, this is about the character and here are just some creative notes and these are actually scenes or these are actually the story beats. And then I'll start to focus on the beats of the story, and I will actually build a table in Word just with a couple of columns. I'll try to structure out an act one somewhat and an act two and an act three, and I'll just try to list very simply, like, this is what happens. Then I will try to take the notes that I have and place them in each of those scenes of what happens. And I just gradually flesh it out more and more until it becomes a full outline. And then the document ends up being like 50 pages. And by that time, you're getting close to an outline that you can simply just write a script right off of. So that's my process. I know people work in a lot of different other more organized and thoughtful ways. And as I said, you know, my way is it sort of creates this, it just creates a path for a character and just captures all my ideas and notes in one place. It is by no means a great formula for story arc and character and premise and theme and all the wonderful things that you need. The one act turn and the, you know, what happens at the end of the second act, I don't take as much of that stuff into consideration until I get into a full draft.
I'd also like to mention to the listeners that Wildlike is a huge success with the film festivals. Let us know a little bit about your take of the film festival run for Wildlike.
Sure. Well, we've been excited about it. I've simply just been trying to get the film out there and seen by as many people as I can. And we've been lucky in the sense that a lot of people have wanted the film. But that said, that's actually been one of the areas where early on it was a real struggle for us. We came into post. We had a great rough cut. We started showing it to some people who were very excited about the film. That was when Killer Films and Christine Vachon came on board, and we got sales agent Kevin Iwashina on board, and they're really terrific and the top of the game at what they do. And so soon after, we started talking to the Toronto Film Festival, and they wrote back some very, you know, encouraging notes. And, you know, kept waiting and waiting until like the very last day, and we didn't get into Toronto, and we were disheartened about that. And then we went through basically the same process with Sundance, and we didn't get in there, and, you know, kept on going festival to festival, which took a long time, because if you're going festival by festival, you know, you're talking each festival for months. So you're kind of waiting around for a long time, and we were still doing a little bit of editing, but not much. And then Hamptons and a couple other people said that they wanted it, and we ended up going to Hamptons, and it's a great festival, and I really enjoyed premiering the movie there. But at that point, I sort of started to think, well, I kind of just want the movie to go around, and let's see if people really want the movie and what the audience reaction is to the movie, and see if we can pick up some awards. And my thought was that maybe it didn't premiere at Sundance, or at Cannes, or at Berlin, but it can garner its own following. And it worked. Thankfully, people have liked the movie, and the response has been very enthusiastic. And there's been a lot of press and interviews like this, and lots of awards. I think we just played like our 77th or 78th film festival. And, you know, they're all different shapes and sizes of festivals, small and big, and you can call them insignificant or whatever. You can say that we are a bigger film in a smaller pond, but I really don't see it that way. It's very competitive on the festival circuit, as anyone who is actively applying knows. Both good and bad movies are getting rejected and accepted into lots of different festivals. And it's simply a great vehicle to show your work to an audience if the festival will take the film. And thank God that they exist, because if they didn't, most of our movies wouldn't be seen by anybody. But the other great thing about it is that because the programmers wanted the movie and the audiences responded to it, and we've gained a nice following on social media, we have a great newsletter list, and we have a lot of programmers who are enthusiastic about the movie coming out. And so we'll be able to, from a grassroots standpoint, reach out to all the people who have seen the movie or want to see the movie and can spread the word and share with their friends when it comes out in the fall.
For those who are not readily accessible or have the access to any local film festivals near them, do you have any plans of pushing Wildlike into something like Netflix or anything like that?
Yeah, we have distribution set up. All the rights are now accounted for. So we have international sales is ongoing. I think it's actually already been released in Latin America. And then, you know, in a few other territories, and that there's, I assume that the rest of the territories will get it eventually, you know, cable, Netflix, all those good places. We have an American distributor, Amplify and Go Digital, which are one company. With Amplify, we're going to put the movie into about 15 cities, theaters in the fall, which is great. And then they will concurrently put it online and on demand and cable and all the usual places you would expect it, and work on making TV deals. And then in Canada, we also have a distributor who will do the same thing in Canada. And we hope to have it in theaters in Montreal, Vancouver, and Toronto, if all goes according to plan, all on the same date, the whole North America.
That's so exciting.
Yeah, so it's very exciting for us. And it's a lot more than a lot of movies can say, of regardless of what film festival they went to. So I think it, you know, fortunately, the audiences seem to really love the movie, and that's helping.
I'm so excited for you. Congratulations with all of this success.
Thank you.
And how important do you think it is to have a mentor in life?
It's funny, someone asked me the other day if I had particular mentors. I don't have one mentor in particular and any one overall. I think I have several people that I've learned from in different subjects in different ways. I think the most important thing, for me at least, was connecting with lots of different people in the film industry, all different types of people working on different types of movies and different types of jobs, and seeing how they do their work, making yourself available to them to be of service to them, whether it's at no cost or low cost or whatever you have to do at the time. And that's where you're going to learn, is by working alongside other people. And then I always say, doing your homework, seeing what filmmakers and people in the industry are making the films that are successful, or that the movies that you love or the movies you want to emulate. And that's what we did when we put together Wildlike. I looked for people who had already worked on movies that I thought were great films. It's not an easy business, but there are a lot of people out there working at it, and a lot of people willing to share their experience, and people always looking for help.
And now, for listeners who are just jumping in and getting their feet wet, as in how to really go about it business-wise, what would you advise them to do?
You know, if you want to be a filmmaker, then you have to work at it. And like I said, it doesn't mean that you're going to be a writer and director every day of your life. You may have to go and be an assistant editor. You may have to go be a production assistant. But what you do in your free time is up to you. You know, if you're stuck, you can always go study, read, and watch. And reading is a great thing. Watching movies, or trying to watch a different genre or something that you wouldn't normally look at. Working with people that you know, just to do any sort of work. And it could be something as simple as taking photographs, or it could be going out with a camera of some kind, or it can be planning a short film, be it simple or complicated. I think that simple tends to be better when you're learning. I think it's a mistake to say, I want to be a filmmaker and I'm going to set out to make this great short film. And, you know, here's 25 pages and it's got all these different locations. And I think that's a mistake, because the chances that you're first or second, or I mean, even any short film, are going to be successful enough to propel you into a job or into a feature film are extremely slim. And it's great to dream and to go after that. And if you want to, then go for it. But that's not how it happened for me. I worked as a producer. I made a lot of different short films, none of which went to Sundance or anything like that, enabled me to make Wildlike. You know, what enabled me to make Wildlike was learning how to be a producer and working really hard on writing a good script, and then talking to everyone I knew about trying to get some money to make the movie.
And was that you yourself finding financiers, or did you have a team?
We ended up with a team. My three producers, Julie Christeas, Skylar Weiss, and Joseph Steffens. I started with a little family money, and then Julie came on board, and then Skylar, and we all looked for some more money from people that we all knew. And then Joe came on and he brought some more money to the table. And then we looked for a little bit more. And it was a long time. I think we raised money for about 2 years.
The script itself, how long did that take?
I think I started that email process probably 2007, maybe 2008. And I think I had a first full workable draft in 2010. But that certainly was not writing on it every day or even every month. It was very work a little bit, weeks go by, work a little bit more. So much of it was thought and notes and sort of flushing out the notes and ideas and that outline, that by the time that was in place, I think the first draft came pretty quickly. But it needed a lot of work beyond that.
Was that you going over the script yourself?
I had one friend who's also a writer, Matt Fabiano, and I brought the idea to Matt and I said, this is what I'm thinking, my idea is, what do you think? And he basically would be a sounding board for the whole thing from conception until several drafts in. I would sit with him and we would go over everything I wrote, and he would say, okay, I don't know if it's really working here, or, you know, why are you doing this? And so he was my sounding board, pretty much my sole sounding board, until Julie and Skylar and Joe got involved.
Yeah, that's so important to have that honest feedback. So what's up for you next? I know you mentioned that you were writing other things. Is there anything that the listeners should look out for?
I actually do a lot of producing work, and I have a company, Catch and Release Films, with my partner, Tom Heller. And Tom and I are developing several projects. As a producer, I've got a small movie coming out called Remittance, which takes place in Singapore and Philippines. So that's coming, working on a doc as a producer with a friend. But yeah, but Tom and I have some exciting books that we have optioned that we're working on. But then, yeah, in terms of writing, in terms of as a director, I don't have my next project yet. I am trying to figure out what to focus on.
Are there any recommended books that you can tell our listeners about?
I need to get those titles in my head readily. There is one book that I came across while in film school that I love called The Visual Story. For a filmmaker, it's a terrific book that talks about, you might think it was a cinematographer's book, but it's really a filmmaker's book at how to look at different scenes and visuals and what they mean. Because you can have a great script and you can have a cinematographer, but you do have to decide where the camera goes and how that's going to tell your story.
That's the first time I'm hearing about this book, so I can't wait to check it out. Frank, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Hey, storytellers, thank you for tuning into episode 15 with Frank Hall Green today. He gave a ton of incredibly helpful tips and advice to help nudge you along in your filmmaking journey. It was really awesome hearing the behind-the-scenes process and the making of his movie Wildlike. Be sure to catch Frank's film in theaters and on demand this Friday, September 25th. Head on over to Twitter and say hi to Frank at Frank Hall Green. To check out Frank's show notes page, visit 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Frank Hall Green. If you're enjoying my podcast, I'd really appreciate it so much if you could please leave me an honest review and rating on iTunes. If you're tuning in right now through your phone, just click on my podcast picture in the podcast app and it'll turn into a big blurb with notes. Tap on the link that says, "Thank you for leaving me an honest review and rating." If you're listening to me on your computer right now, please head over to 88cupsoftea.com and click on Leave a Review at the top of the page. If you think this episode or any of the other previous episodes you listened to may help a friend, a relative, a coworker, or a classmate, please share this podcast with them. It makes me so happy when I hear how the podcast has helped listeners. Thank you guys so much again for listening in and joining me on this journey. I'm so grateful to all of you. Have an awesome start to your week.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!